Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
All right, today we're talking about shooters, and not the type you find in a bar. I know it's not a good joke comparison whatsoever, but I did talk about this on Facebook, and that was the response I got.
Yep.
So shooters, we've been dealing with a lot, and it's really unfortunate. We've had shooters at synagogues, we've had shooters at churches, we've had shooters at schools, and shooters at movie theaters. And, you know, I know many have made this argument, especially in, you know, more bigger movements such as Black Lives Matter and Antifa, but I do subscribe to the concept of let's stop calling them shooters and let's just call them terrorists.
Intuitively, at least, I resonate with that, and I think that's a proper perspective to have on it, because shooters go hunting, you know, for game, and often for table food. So taking that concept and lumping under it what these madmen, mad persons do in killing other people as a shooter is a wrong concept. The idea of doing it for terrorist purposes, however delusional they may be, is a much better way to look at it. I agree with that.
So how do we define the difference between shooter and terrorist? Because when I think about it, shooter, you know, they shoot. But a terrorist, the purpose is to cause terror, to cause fear, right, to spread anger, or to promote a manifesto.
Right. Well, it's the difference between target and purpose. A shooter can just be, like I say, a hunter, you know, shooting game. And they can be doing it for survival or to supply food for the table or for just to be shooting at target practice, you know, like go at gun range, you can be a shooter at a gun range. Mm-hmm. Now, if your intent and purpose in developing those shooting skills, however, is to generate terror and to murder human beings, that's not just being a shooter, that's being a terrorist.
If we leave it at that lenient of a definition, we do run into this. We discussed this briefly last night, where then if you're part of the armed forces, if you're training for the purpose of shooting a human and that causes them terror, in a way that almost makes you like a terrorist. So I think it's important for us to clarify that's not what we're talking about.
I don't think we can completely back away from it, and I'll tell you why, briefly. The most effective weapon in warfare is fear.
Okay.
So if you're a soldier in a military action, you want to scare your enemy into a position where you can target them.
Now, is that just offensive, or is that offensive and
both
defensive?
It's okay. Both. I mean, if you set up a defense such that as the enemy approaches, things happen, be they sounds or noises or lights or, you know, trenches with barbs in them or whatever, you set up mechanisms that are supposed to keep them from advancing, that scare them about advancing. You're using terror as a weapon. You're using fear, that sense of imminent danger. And if you use the word terror to describe that, it's terrorist activity. Now, it's a bit of a stretch, I grant you. But ultimately, where that's going to bottom out is the just war versus the unjust war discussion.
That's a point of view discussion, though.
Yeah.
So, okay, so maybe I should retry my definition here. If I try to expand on it, you know, okay, fine-tuning. It's like the idea where your proposed thesis is this ornate Chinese dragon, and then your approved thesis is this paper dragon. Right? We have to go through so many details.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we change it, if we focus a bit, the shooter or armed forces, whatever, we'll leave that to the side. If I specifically define terrorist as somebody who uses terror as an offensive measure outside of a... See, I don't even want to go there, because if I say outside of militia, then that removes the jihadist regime, and we want to include that because it is terrorism.
Yeah.
And 9/11 was definitely terrorism, even though it was organized. So, individuals or groups that are intentionally inciting terror and hysteria for the purpose of pushing their propaganda or manifesto in an offensive matter.
That's to the purpose, right.
Because if I think about it, if I use scare tactics to try to terrorize somebody from attacking me, I don't want to label that as terrorism, because that's self-defense.
Okay.
Because they didn't need to walk into that.
I understand.
They chose to.
Yeah.
My issue is that when we are, because the person is white, we're calling them a shooter. Because if the person was anything other than Caucasian, they would have been labeled as a terrorist or an extremist.
This is true.
So that's my big thing, and I like to go beyond the concept of Islamophobia and different types of racial prejudices and say that it's just not okay. It doesn't matter your culture, doesn't matter your theology, your point of view, worldview. Yeah, it doesn't matter any ethnicity or anything. Doing something like that, forcing that harm and taking of life or injury for the purpose of pushing your manifesto that is harming others, mm-hmm. To me, it's just not okay.
So is it ideology?
I think there is a component there to it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't want to say that the U.S. Marines going into a country is necessarily a terrorist action. I'd like to hope...
It can be, but it isn't necessarily.
I like to hope that there's more oversight to prevent it from being simply, let's terrorize you, but there's an actual purpose, right. And we want to reduce the loss of life instead of increase it.
Right.
And I feel like if somebody's trying to reduce the loss of life, that's better in a way, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I guess where I still am kind of in the nebulous area is when I think of shooting or being a shooter, I think of a skill. I think of a craft. I think of an ability. Okay, I have an instrument. I have a tool.
Okay.
And I use it with skill and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
A good shooter is one who knows his weapon, his or her weapon. Mm-hmm. And uses it for right purposes, and that's where we're trying to draw the line here.
Yeah,
what is a right purpose for exercising that shooter skill? So it is a category mistake to think of the shooter as the act. You see what I'm saying? I mean, the shooter is the skill; the act is the terror.
Yeah,
or not. So that's kind of where I'm trying to find the demarcation that works to render them both explicit and clear. And for me, I don't want to give up on thinking of shooter and shooting as a skill and an ability, a disciplined, honed, craft, skill, ability. The application of that ability is where the lines between self-defense, just war, you know, you're applying those skills and crafts and the instruments thereof in right or wrong ways. And the terrorist side of it is definitely a wrong way, I would say.
Yeah. I'm curious. We're going to try this out because we're recording face-to-face and we can actually pull this off.
Okay.
I'm curious what the average response to this would be. Like, how do we define this? Ready? Okay, Google. Define terrorist.
Here's the definition of terrorist. A person who uses unlawful violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, in the pursuit of political aims.
Okay, so the three things, unlawful,
yeah,
civilians,
uh-huh,
political aims. Those were the distinguishing criteria, right?
Well, it was targeting civilians. It wasn't necessarily civilians.
Right. Yeah, right.
Which I do think is important because, you know, if you have a militia, they're not necessarily civilians in your reference, but they can still do terrorist actions.
Yeah.
I think that to me describes all the recent shootings. Those are acts of terror, and they'd be classified as terrorists under that definition.
I think that's right.
So why aren't we calling them that?
Prejudice and bias. Built in a cultivated prejudice and bias. The white privilege. It's a dimension of white privilege, plain and simple. I mean, it's hard for me to think of it any other way. You know, if I... a 70-year-old Extinction Rebellion activist was not complying with Extinction Rebellion peaceful, nonviolent activism and became a terrorist for Extinction Rebellion or fighting mass extinction. I wouldn't be in Extinction Rebellion if I did this. But if I were to go into a bank and just start randomly slaughtering customers and staff and employees, I'd be a shooter.
Yeah.
If you, as an Orthodox Jew, went into, let's say, a bank and started shooting the same targets, the same civilians, the same weapon, everything else identical except Jew, WASP, right? You'd be a terrorist. in my community's eyes, you'd be a terrorist, but I'd be a shooter. And that's the prejudice that's at work here, I think. That's and I'm picking on you, you know, because it's just a convenient example. But if it's a white person, it's the white privilege kicks in. Don't you think?
No, I do agree to this, yeah. Now, what you did was you opened up this doorway here, okay?
Okay.
Because you brought in the Jewish elements, right? So a personal frustration of mine is the news media cycle and how they report things.
Of course.
Okay? Hamas, a terrorist organization, runs Gaza, starves its people, manipulates them with media to incite rebellion, so that they can hide behind kids and hide in hospitals to shoot their rockets.
Yeah.
They can shoot 500 rockets at Israel.
Now, just to be clear, you're talking about the Palestinian Hamas, right?
I'm talking about Hamas, the terrorist organization that runs Palestine.
Got it.
Yes. And they're particularly on the Gaza Strip is where a lot of this action has been recently.
Right.
They'll locate themselves in schools and hospitals and launch the rockets from there.
Right.
500 rockets in 3 days, goes at Israel, the Iron Dome deflects what it can. Some rockets do hit. Some people die or get injured, right?
Right.
The news media doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
They just say, oh, more issues in the Middle East or unrest.
Right.
The Iron Dome blocks it. As a result, a place in Gaza is hit, like an empty school or something. Or if IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, targets the rocket launcher, and they have to shoot the school.
Yeah.
Now they're terrorists, and that's war crimes.
I totally get that, and it's unjust. It is wrongly judgmental in the extreme. And it's an inversion of the same kind of prejudice and bias. It turns more, I think, on cultural differences than it does on ethnic or racial differences. But correct me if I'm wrong about that.
I think there's truth to that. The other thing I will have to admit is I personally feel like the current Israeli government sucks at marketing.
That's an interesting perspective to put on it.
IDF has recently done great trying to summarize what these actions were in these GIFs that they post on Instagram. That's right, wonderful.
Right. So but who's better marketing their propaganda?
I don't see Netanyahu on the world news saying this has happened and this is what really is going on and here's what we're doing about it.
Oh, well.
What I see is the narrative from Hamas. They're really good at marketing. How do we know this? We deal with people that are leaving the UK, leaving the US, to go join ISIS or Hamas or any of those groups. We know they're effective in that regard. They've got the marketing machine figured out. I don't understand why is Israel silent on this. I mean,
I have no answer. I mean, that's not something I could even confidently speculate about.
As a diaspora Jew, one living outside of Israel, like, no, this is, it's an issue. I go to work with people who, because of this marketing machine, they feel that what Israel is doing is wrong and corrupt, and that it's unjust, and they feel that they should just let it be Palestinian state, because it's Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
But then I have the issue with this. Palestine, that's a made-up term. It's a made-up word. It's not a nation, and it's not really a people. What you have is you have Jews and Arabs. Palestine was established after 70 Common Era, after destruction of the Temple, by the Roman government, when they started causing the diaspora and forcing Jews out of their land, they renamed Israel Palestine so that people would forget their homeland and forget their identity.
Mm.
Now, I understand, oh, it's been 2,000 years about. So I understand, well, 2,000 years ago is Israel, since somebody called it Palestine, fine. But technically, everybody living there is Jew or Arab, not.
And we just celebrated the anniversary.
Yes, yes. So when we're recording this short, just a day after Israeli Independence Day for 71 years.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing.
There's 2,000 years in between. That's the rub, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when I see people coming to the table to discuss peace.
A phrase comes back to me.
Yes.
For our third topic.
Yes.
How to be critical or critique or think your way through Israeli policy without being anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic. How do you come to grips with that anti-Semitic, anti-Zionism and still be able to rightly say Israel policy is wrong about this, without it coming across as being against having an Israeli nation or against Jews as a group.
Yeah.
That was our third topic.
That actually ties into this a lot.
Which is why I thought of it.
Yeah. So that we will discuss that shortly, but right now we're dealing with the shooter versus terrorist.
I get that. We don't even have to go into that. I just wanted to get it on the record because I remembered it.
We will. I mean, the truth is, a lot of people have already said a lot about shooter versus terrorist. It's not something new. We're just echoes of we need to change this.
Yeah. No, I agree. On that particular aspect of the shooter versus terrorist dimension, I go back to what I already said. I don't want to be redundant, but skill versus purpose. Putting it a little over simply.
Yeah.
You can develop the skill and fight for peace, just war, righteous military. You can develop the skill and be a terrorist and just be brutally violent on delusional principle. That's a lot of what goes on. And what comes into play that takes advantage of that distinction is white privilege. That's one of the things that comes into play.
So, we're going to apply this to a couple situations.
Okay.
It's going to tick off some listeners, okay?
Okay.
Boston Tea Party. Is this a terrorist action?
No. I see the Boston. You're talking about 17th century?
Yes.
Or 18th century American Boston. That Boston, not the Tea Party of the 20th century.
No.
Okay. The Boston Tea Party was a tax rebellion. They were rebelling against taxes, and it was an act of civil disobedience. And it directly didn't harm anybody in any violent way.
Just the economics of the East India Tea.
Right.
Okay.
It was doing to the East India Tea Company what ought to be done to the fossil fuel industry today.
And that's your connection to insurrection.
That's the connection. I'm going to make those connections.
Oh, definitely. I get it. Yeah. So Boston Tea Party, fine. Not a terrorist thing. It is a civil disobedience and uprising, I guess.
Right.
Okay, all right. The United States using armed forces to take over Hawaii.
Did that happen?
The Queen was held at gunpoint.
Oh, you're right. Yes, yes, yes.
And
history is coming back to me.
We say it's a military campaign and it was for the good of the nation.
I don't think so. I'd have to know the history a lot better than I do to come to this conclusion as a conviction.
Yeah.
But my hypothesis would be, I don't know that I would go so far. It comes awfully close to that line of terrorism.
Yeah.
But it's a tyranny. It's an imperialism. But the difference between tyranny and imperialism is more a matter of how just are the values that are driving it. And when it's tyranny and imperialism, there's no justice. There's no question of justice. There's just power.
Yeah, so that's as colonialism, so to me, absorption.
Right. And so for that case, I would say you could characterize it as terrorism and not be far off the mark.
Okay.
If at all.
All right. And then the Holocaust.
That was terrorism to the core.
I mean, nobody calls it terrorism.
I know.
Which surprises me.
Well... We had this conversation. Language is always going to be a problem. We've touched on this a couple of times in the last few days.
But that's the purpose of this podcast.
I understand. Nobody calls it terrorism because there's so much baggage in the late 20th and current times around the concept of terrorism. And we Orwell was dead right. We have lost. I mean, going back to the Tower of Babel, like we were talking about. We had how many languages at that time? 20, 30?
Not nearly as many.
No, it was just one at Babel.
Yeah, it was just one.
And then it became like a couple of dozen. Well, today, I know this is a Wycliffe Bible translator, there are over 7,000 languages. And what's the biggest problem in every marriage? Communication. We don't understand each other when we talk.
Yeah.
We are incapable of taking the meaning we have in our minds and hearts and handing it to somebody intact. And the only mechanism we have to do that is speech. And the semantics of human speech disappeared at the Tower of Babel. Now, here we are 2,000 plus, well, almost 3,000 years later, right? Mm-hmm. And it has only gotten worse. And through time, cultures ebb and flow and the semantics of the concepts built into their language become so loaded with baggage and emotional intensity that the meaning of the conversation using the language to talk about it is just lost. This is why Orwell was so prophetic. I mean, Newspeak is where we live when we talk politics. I mean, I repeatedly, in my recent posts, characterize any political conversation as double plus good duck speaking, which is straight out of Orwell. And it's essentially words that are flowing without meaning. They're noise. They're sounds. They're ducks quacking.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this 2016 political convention for the presidency. I mean, that's a poster child case of double. It worked. It was effective. It was double plus good. But it was noise. It was semantic gibberish. So it's duck speak. But that's exactly what Orwell was telling us we would be facing. And here we are. Here we are. So back to your point. When you use the word terrorism, the exercise of defining exactly what you mean by it before you start talking cases, those conversations don't happen. Like this conversation doesn't happen. You bring up terrorism in a bar, you bring up terrorism in a church, bring up terrorism in an academic classroom, and you immediately get polarization.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can get past the polarization to have a rational conversation about it. And there are exceptions, but they are rare. This is why this conversation is so rare. It's because we really want to be clear about what we mean and then talk about the cases. But most conversations that try to talk about this stuff, they immediately say, well, here's what happened in Poway, and it was not terrorism. Well, why? Well, I just don't need to explain that. Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but yeah, you do need to explain that, right?
Well, especially to me personally, especially with Poway, and that not just because of me being Jewish, but because the shooter chose to identify themselves as a Christian doing a Christian act. They posted a manifesto on how the Jews are controlling the world, and they intentionally went and targeted at the same time the prayers during Passover were prayers for the deceased and departed.
I understand.
To me, yeah, that's clearly an act of terror because you meant to incite terror.
Oh, yeah. It was meant to. It was the exercise of skill.
Mm-hmm.
However well refined it was is debatable, but nevertheless, a shooting capability. It was the exercise of that capability for a wildly diluted ideology. I hesitate to even call it ideology because it was fragmented, dissonant insanity, really.
Sorry.
As near as I could tell. Madness.
So here's a segue, okay? This segues into Israeli policy a bit, okay?
Well, did we cover all the cases you want to
cover? I am covering right here.
Okay, all right,
ready?
All right.
There is a policy in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it is... So... To give you a bit of background, when Israel, during the wars, took over areas of land, the areas that they didn't immediately re-give to the neighboring countries, it's not how it's being portrayed in the news media. It is not these suffering Palestinians, these suffering Arabs being oppressed. It's not Rwanda. It's not any of those locations. Israel provides them healthcare, provides them food, provides them money, and gave them the opportunity to become Israel citizens. Just, you want to be a citizen and support our country, you can participate in all these things. You don't want to? Fine. We'll still give you all this, but you can't vote. That's what's going on. That's literally what's going on in these so-called annexed areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when somebody chooses to identify as a Palestinian, they're saying that they want all the benefits of Israel's giving them. They're just not voting because they don't want Israel there. But they're still taking the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Currently, if a Palestinian terrorist, and I imagine this would be for any type of terrorist, but I know that Israel has recently done this a few times with Palestinian terrorists. There's a man that was very big on being Zionism, and it was Ari Folz, and he was attacked. A Palestinian knifed him in public with his family and started running off. What he did, IDF trained, he chases the man who knifed him and he shoots him down in the street and then he dies.
Uh-huh.
Okay? The knifer, labeled a terrorist.
Yeah.
If he wouldn't have died, he would be sentenced to death.
Yeah.
But not just that. The family home is established, or who is the family, where is the home? They're kicked out, the home's demolished, and they rebuild for a different family, an Israeli family that's moving into the area to take over that place. The erasing the terrorist and their family, their erasement from the land.
And its history.
Well, the history still exists because we still have mourning over the events.
Right. You've got the impact of the act.
Yeah, when it comes to death and loss, we never forget. We always mourn.
Yeah.
So the question is that, and what's your thoughts on that policy?
Is it just?
Yeah. Not righteous, but is it just?
What's the difference?
Well, I don't think we can really get into righteous without trying to get into our point of view and our religious worldview.
I see. Okay. In terms of the law, jurisprudence, I would say it's just. It was a proportionate response, even a slightly gracious response, actually. Because the eye for an eye would have been, who's the patriarch of your polity?
I have to clarify something there.
Yeah.
We actually, in the Torah, before we're given an eye for an eye, it says you cannot cause suffering and you cannot cause hardship. So eye for an eye is not saying it's an eye for an eye. It's saying you must do recompensation for what that person lost as a result of the injury.
Right, right.
You have to pay for their medical. You have to pay for the shame. Pay for their...
My mistake. Proportionate punishment.
Yes.
Barring grace and mercy. Okay, just rebalancing the justice of it. Under those kind of legal considerations, I would say that it was a just response.
Do you feel that it deters people from committing acts of terror? Not just you with your American perspective.
I understand.
Do you feel that?
I don't think you can get past a case by case on that.
Okay.
I don't think you could generalize that without being wrong as often as you're right.
So here's
because
where...
Because simply, that person who knifed the fella, he had whatever he broadcast or proclaimed to be his purpose.
Mm-hmm.
How deranged that was, how deluded it was, how insane it was, or not, is undetermined. Right? Because no psychological assessment was done to determine, is he sane enough to stand trial? Was there?
No, he was killed in action.
Exactly. So that kind of remains a mystery as to whether or not you could really judge it. It's kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, or James Earl Ray, or, well, Sirhan Sirhan's a counterexample. But James Earl Ray, Lee Harvey Oswald especially, and here's where it starts to overlap with the, one way in which it starts to overlap with the terrorist shooter discussion is lone gunmen. They all are always lone gunmen. Do we really believe that?
Well, the lone gunman seems to be more of an American unique
thing. It
tends
to be. It does. But, I there's the jackal in France. He's an assassin. He's not just a lone gunman. He, she is supposedly an assassin. Hired killer.
That's not a lone gunman. Hired.
It's not. And you know somebody hired them. So there's a bigger story. And I'm always, my hackles of suspicion and conspiracy suspicion arise every time a shooting by a shooter occurs in America that it was truly a lone gunman. I think back of the guy who was in Vegas, who got the corner room.
Mm-hmm. And just opened up?
Opened up with a, what's it, a kick stock, I think they call it. That you can't automate the weapon, but you have a certain kind of stock you can put on it. You just hold the trigger and it bounces.
Yeah, so it's almost like...
It's like an auto rifle.
Yeah.
And I think he was using a bump stock. That's what it is. I think he was using bump stocks. And he was pretty effective as a shooter.
Yeah. I see the quotation marks for shooter.
I did that visually. Yeah. I put quotes around the shooter. As a terrorist.
Yeah.
He was efficient. He was a good shooter. He exercised his craft effectively. You know? So he was a good shooter. But when you add in what he was shooting at and why, he becomes a terrorist. To go back to that point. But every time the idea of the lone gunman comes up, I'm skeptical.
That seems... Okay, so Poway.
It's not that they don't exist, but they're... The idea of the Manchurian candidate is what always occurs to me. That somebody in the shadows, manipulated the circumstances around this individual in such a way that they felt compelled to do what they did. Now, I'm not offering that as an excuse, but I am offering it as a hypothetical explanation of terrorist behavior that shouldn't be automatically ruled out. And we tend to automatically rule out and hide a lot of conspiracy under the lone gunman theory. Okay. And that's kind of an aside, but it plays into finding that clear demarcation between the craft of shooting and the act of terror.
Okay, so two parts I want to bring into this. First part being this Israeli policy. I understand the culture is different. I mean, it's obviously different. From within the Jewish realm, when you go to Israel, everybody's mishpacha, everybody's family in some way.
Right.
And so the community watches out for each other. If somebody faints from heat exhaustion, everybody runs over to help. They all have their solutions. And it's different than it is here. It reminds me of the book we had read, The Vanishing Neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost that sense of being neighborly here. Yeah. It still very much exists in Israel. And so
it's
there's
not here, but you're right.
And there is a cultural difference in Israel compared to America, and that's that with the Poway shooter, the parents said, we had no idea. He lived with his parents. The parents said, we had no idea. We condemn his actions. We will not provide him legal assistance. He should pay for his crimes. Okay? But then we also, if we're talking about the lone shooter concept, the shooter terrorist himself flat out says that the Pittsburgh attack on the synagogue, which was 6 months to the day earlier, inspired him. And then New Zealand encouraged him to take immediate action. And that's what he did. He saw those. He felt that the Jews were controlling the world because of how he's being manipulated into this white nationalism or anti-Semitism that seems to defy logic to me. And it leads him to the conclusion of this is what he needs to do.
This is the right thing for me to do.
Yeah. So, one, there's that, but two, should the parents be responsible for knowing what's happening in their own home?
Yeah, my immediate intuitive answer to that is absolutely. I mean, that's what it is to be a parent, is to know your child. And the less you know your child, the less well you're parenting.
Now,
that's kind of a broad generalization. It is a broad generalization, but I think it holds a lot of water.
I do want to clarify, I'm not trying to condemn the parents.
I do, I get that.
Yeah, for this event. But to me, it highlights a systematic cultural disease where we no longer have the concept of being neighborly. We no longer have the concept of getting to know each other and being aware. Because if there was community, somebody would have said that could have stopped this.
I cannot argue and would not argue against any of those claims. I do want to go back to the difference between the justice of what happened in Israel to the knife attack and the righteousness of that. I can't speak to the righteousness of it because I'm not a Jew. You would have to speak to it as a Jew as to whether or not it fits Hasidic or Jewish righteousness.
Well, I can tell you flat out, at least from an Orthodox perspective, we can't declare the righteousness of it because we're not the king, we're not the high priest, and we're not God.
I get that. And to me, that makes a lot of spiritual sense. I mean, the difficulty is it separates you from acting on what you feel to be a righteous judgment.
Well, we have a law, okay? Yeah. We have a Torah law that says, do not stand idly by your neighbor's blood. And what that means is if we know somebody will be hurt or killed as a result of this action or inaction, we are obligated to intervene.
If that requires prior knowledge.
Well, not necessarily. In the case of the knifing, to kick out the family, demolish the home, it discourages a similar attack.
So that goes back to your question. Is it, what was the word?
We justify it.
Yeah.
We justify it using our Torah law, but we can't say whether or not it's righteous itself.
No, that wasn't your question that I'm thinking of. The question you asked me was, does it discourage?
Yeah. Does it? I think in Israel it does because of the culture.
Because of the community sense.
My belief is I would love for that to take place here in America, but I think it would be a failure because our culture says we don't know anything about our neighbor, we don't know anything about our family.
You're absolutely right. but we're starting to get into an area of my view of the reality of the ideological and political reality we're in, mm-hmm. which is America has intentionally demarcated itself on every ideological front from the rest of the world, precisely so they can divide American population, not just citizens, but illegal aliens, mm-hmm. The immigrants, the illegal from many countries. We divide them, and they're not citizens. We marginalize them and castigate them, and, you know, but we do the same thing from the left to the right, from the middle to the progressive. I mean, the powers that be over American culture have deliberately structured it, I believe, and I'm fairly convinced based on evidence, have deliberately structured through the media, through the daily lives of the people who live in this country, citizens or not, such that unless you get the hell out of this country and learn what it looks like from other parts of the world, you can't even figure out who you are in America, much less your neighbor. So what do? You create an identity based on what you're being fed. This goes to the Charles Taylor book, mm-hmm. Secular Age, the buffered identity, right? Used to be porous. We were in community. I got to know you, you got to know me, and we found parts of our identity in that relationship. We identified with our neighbor. We don't do that anymore. We're in this bubble, and this bubble buffers us from each other. And we use that buffering to come up with our own fantasy of what reality is. And that reality consists of the imminent frame that I, as an individual, create out of my own imagination, however dull it may be, but I create it out of whatever whole cloth I seize on. And the whole cloth I seize on is the social imaginary, in Taylor's terms, that's created by the powers that be. And right now, the most powerful force in that is social media. This is why this kid, right, in Poway was able to create a social, draw from a social imaginary that his parents knew nothing of. I'm not blaming the social media, but I don't know what else he could have created this delusion from. I mean, was he hanging out with other fascist madmen?
I don't know enough about that.
We don't know, see? But I suspect he created it out of the social imaginary that he picked and chose from, whether it was people or I think quite likely social media. And so he pulled from that social imaginary, created this imminent frame within which he was free to justify whatever he felt was justified by the social imaginary, and it led him into this, 6 months to the day, and what happened in New Zealand, I got to do it now. And so there he went. And it's madness. It's madness to the core. And it's exactly what you're talking about. But my point is, it's deliberately, semiotically engineered to pit us against one another. Because if we're fighting each other, we won't notice what those powers are doing in the rest of the world.
True.
Like Venezuela today. Mm-hmm. And it's their third or fourth time to try to bring off a coup in that country and take it over. Why? Oil. They're one of the largest, if not the largest, one of the largest oil reserves untapped in the world. That's what it's about. It's about the oil. And that tragicomic melodrama circus is playing out all around the globe. And we in America are more concerned about, does my new iPhone give me all the features I want? You know? I mean, and I really don't like liberals. Oh, I hate conservatives. Oh, I can't stand these progressives and socialists. My God, they should be shot on sight. I mean, this is the dialogue you have in America. Most of the time, most places, most relationships, most encounters are around differences and division. They're not around community and unity. And so you're right dead on to what the problem is in America. With the white privilege factored into it, these madmen like this kid shooter, that's what we propagate.
Okay.
And so it's engineered. It's the fruit of that engineering. How deliberately it is, how manipulated it is, so that there isn't really a lone gunman. At the broad level, there aren't any lone gunmen. We create them. We design and create them like Manchurian candidates. Whether we make this individual one of those or not, we don't care. As long as we can get 50 of them to pop up in a year, we've accomplished the goal. That's what I think is going on. Shoot me as a conspiracy theorist if you like. Call me a terrorist if you like. But that's what I think is going on. This is not some kind of unpredictable evolution of culture. This is a semiotically designed, engineered state of reality, irreality. And it's poisonous. Most poisonous fruit is things like shooter slash terrorist behavior.
Okay.
Now, that's kind of a stump for me, okay? I didn't mean to get polemic on you, but...
No, it's fine. A little, some of it's philosophical, but we can work with that, right? We need to discuss and look over it and percolate on a couple things with that. One of the things, we've talked about the cultural difference and how we don't have that sense of neighborly or community anymore in America. If we had that type of policy that Israel has, would people seek out to establish that community? If they knew that they're responsible for their neighbor's actions or inactions, that they have an obligation to watch out for their neighbor, would they be more likely to?
That's a hard question. Because on the one side of that coin, you're saying if there were a law that required it, if it were policy that you do this.
Yeah.
Well, the other flip side of that coin is not the kind of thing, it's morality. You can't legislate the moral.
Well, we do with see something, say something, which is kind of what that is, but this one's saying, no, you're accountable if you don't say something.
It does go that extra step. And the answer is it would be an interesting experiment. My intuition says it would probably fail. Why? Because it doesn't serve the higher purpose.
But it also feels like a police state in some regards. If you're constantly being spied on by your neighbor, you're not wanting to encourage community by using fear tactics. You want to encourage community because that's what we need.
Well, that's the agenda. I'm sorry I went down this path and I'm having a hard time backing away from it. The agenda is for me to spy on you. So on the one hand, morally, I think it's a good thing to do. Practically, I think it's the inversion that we're actually engineering. It's the inversion of that right mentality, moral mentality, that the powers that be are turning inside out. They're making it a police state when it should be community unity. And the behaviors are very similar, but one's nefarious and one's moral.
So setting aside the Orthodox Jewish communities, which we all live next to each other, so our community is also our tribal affiliation.
Yeah.
And that's just because we walk on Shabbat, and so we need our synagogue to be within walking distance.
Yeah, yeah.
Setting aside that, communities typically seem to be a bit more diverse. It's regardless of what your tribalism is, regardless of your nationalism, where you live does not necessarily reflect that. If we started being more community-focused, you'd have diversity.
That would require economic mobility. And economic mobility, I think you would agree that economic mobility in the United States ain't nothing like what it's cracked up to be.
No.
Now, how hard would you have to work to move out of where you live today to something, say, an order of magnitude higher up the economic scale? You got a chance at that in this lifetime?
I don't think so, no.
I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
And that's the screws that tighten, see? It goes right back to capitalism. Those are the screws that tighten. They tighten you down economically. They tighten you down ideologically. They tighten you down to where you're divided against everyone but yourself, and eventually you become divided against yourself and you become totally dissonant. I'm sorry. I keep going off in that direction. I'll try to stop.
So, you know, reviewing it in my head, thinking through this, okay, so it sounds like tribalism, nationalism, it's a type of fascism, and it's not where we want to be. Nationalism is what caused the nation-state catastrophe of the First World War and the Second World War, and the past two or three years, Dr. Lensweet had us write a semiotics paper to try to predict where we were going. And I flat out said, we're going to tribalism and nationalism. Look where we are. That's the benefit of semiotics. If people don't connect the dots yet, you see what's going on.
Right.
But I almost want to say it's that's not where we should be. We should not be identifying tribalism and nationalism, because that is a type of fascism that is not, that doesn't love your neighbor. It does not protect people, does not keep people safe.
It's insular. I mean, you're isolating and insulating on
which
both of those
that only allows extremism. Yeah, right. Because if everybody has the same opinion, then you must be right.
Yeah.
So what we need is community. We need to come back to community and who are my neighbors?
Right.
Which is a very New Testament thing. I remember the one person who said, what do I need to do? Go and love your neighbor. Well, who's my neighbor? I remember that narrative, right? And we actually have another Jewish phrase that's a law, is do not put a stumbling block before the blind. If we know something's going to trip somebody up or cause them to make a mistake, it's not okay. It's a sin for us to do that. And so at the same time, bringing this law could cause a police state. I also wonder if we try to make a focus on community connection, be neighborly, and you're not watching out for each other to report each other, watching out for each other to keep each other from doing something wrong.
Well, it the tribalism, nationalism, identity questions,
mm-hmm.
individual identity, tribal identity, national identity, whatever scale, scope, or range you put around the idea of identity, that's where I think you really have to start unpacking this. Because if you start with tribalism, start with nationalism, you're not getting to the roots that those spring from. They're forms of identity, personal, communal, collective. They're forms of identity. The root identity we have to start with is we are all human beings. So if we can begin to understand what makes us human, of the same being, coincidentally or divinely in the same presence at the same time, now we can start talking about community and unity. But as soon as we say, well, I'm this kind of human, and I have this kind of being on the basis of my tribal relationships or my even family relationships, as soon as you start categorically differentiating beyond being a human being currently present, you're inviting tribalism and nationalism and statism and identities that lead to fascism or some form of totalitarian tyranny of some kind. But we seem utterly incapable culturally of staying on that base denominator that's common. We're all human. We all have the same being as humans. And our being is manifest in this time in our presence as humans here and now. But as soon as we start saying, well, this is my past. This is my connection. This is who I am. We've divided ourselves from everybody who isn't that. And those divisions are where the terror comes from.
So, thinking on that, Rashi, it's an acronym, right? But he's known as Rashi. Great rabbinic authority. Around, I believe, 1000 Common Era. I could be totally wrong. But near the time of the Crusades,
mm-hmm.
he tended a vineyard. He partnered with the local church tending the vineyard together. They would share recipes and work together to produce wine. He made good relationships with the local Christians, Catholics, however you want to say it. That's contrary to Orthodox concepts now, which is, well, no, there's Jewish and then there's non-Jewish and there's this division, right? But that he was anti-divisive in that regard. And to me, that sets a precedent saying, you may have a tribal identity, but that tribal identity should not prevent, should not block, but rather should encourage and promote you to bridge the gap and get to know others.
I totally agree. I mean, to me, that's what makes this dialogue in building these bridges the right noble purpose for us to be doing based on what we've shared and experienced. And I have no problem, Yoni, thinking of you as a fellow human being. And I don't have to go further than that. I don't have to go further than that, other than to say, how do we identify Jewishness, Christianity, Jew-Christian, and say, why are those differences conflicting? Why are those differences not harmonious? You can't deny the differences.
Yeah.
They're there. You're going to inherit them the moment you pop out of the bottle or the womb or whatever.
Yeah.
But how do you harmonize them? and keep the humanness intact and keep the being in the present intact and not let those things become sources of difference and conflict and dissonance and, division.
That, I don't want to go here because it's too much to unpack and it requires it's almost its own dissertational thing. But from the Christian perspective regarding Jews, it's religious difference, correct?
Essentially.
From the Jewish perspective regarding Christians, it's religious difference, cultural difference, and physical difference.
Ethnic, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Being born Jewish, being born non-Jewish, there's a belief that it's a different type of soul.
Great.
But that can be overcome.
Okay.
I'm not trying to, I don't want to inflame any listeners or cause disruption here. I argue in my dissertation that can be overcome. And in an earlier draft that I plan on working into a publication in the future that I briefly discussed on YidBrick, the website part of the dissertation, is that part can be overcome because it's not saying, oh, well, if somebody is a non-Jew, they're lesser. No, I don't want that type of perspective. What I want the narrative to be is that as a Jew, I'm held to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. As a non-Jew, you complement and harmonize the picture by doing what I cannot and have not done, and I do what you're not expected to do. We complete each other.
Yeah, that's the resonance and harmony
and that
differences.
Yeah, that's where I feel like the mandorla needs to be the focus, and let's forget the rest.
I agree totally. What's to be preserved, the instrument through which the resonant harmony is played, if you will, is the common humanity, being and presence, being in the present as humans, and all of those other differences, Jew, Christian, people of color, economic, all of those other differences, in that basic sense, are incidental. And cultures and societies and civilizations, such as we call them, turn on those differences. So we can't minimize them. We can't pretend they don't matter, because they do shape reality in which we have our human being in presence. But we have to keep separate that reality from the more fundamental reality of our humanity and our being present as humans at the same time. That's not something we can change. No. I mean, think of Lynn. How many times have you heard him say, I'm in the wrong time. I should be in the Victorian era, right? But for such a time as this, my being is now present here with you having this conversation,
mm-hmm.
and it's serving a purpose, and I think a noble one. But it's really dangerous to lose connection to that common ground, because that's where we are one. That's where the unity of community is rooted, I believe. And if you try to ignore differences, you're going to create differences by ignoring them. I know that sounds paradoxical, but you're setting yourself apart from what's real. And that's a big mistake. If you try to build a different or better identity than that common denominator based on those differences, you're now in dissonance with your own being and presence. See what I'm saying? I mean, it's a tough nut to crack. But you're right. We have to complement each other in that resonant harmony. Whatever sets us as different isn't something to divide over. It's something to build from that common ground on. Same thing happened between science and theology in my dissertation. I had to find something that was a common ground that would let me to bring them into resonant harmony, and that something is semiotics, plain and simple. And it works out beautifully if you can make it through the dissertation. But I totally get what you're saying, I think, and I totally agree with it, or I wouldn't be having these conversations around building the bridges, you know?
Yeah. In the past, we've talked about how people get lost into their social fantasy, and they've made a fantasy world for them. They get stuck in their head. Not going too deep in that, but just briefly, just for the sake of those type of listeners who may be listening, I want to clarify whether or not you think mutants exist, whether or not you think DNA structure of one type of people is different from another, and suddenly somebody else is less human, which is an anti-Semitic trope that has been used in the past. No matter what you believe regarding that, what I see the common humanity as connecting that makes that unity is it's a Jewish concept, okay? What separates humans from dogs, from cows, from other animals? There's three words for soul. Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama, okay? Every created being, all animals, everything, has a nefesh. They have a soul of some sort. They have a body and a spirit and a soul. Humankind was not only given life, but was breathed into, which is Ruach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes us different from animals, from a Jewish perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is the core of all humanity, regardless of somebody's genetics, DNA, race.
It transcends the genetic frame into which it was breathed.
So for people who live in, well, maybe there's mutants today, I want to clarify, they probably still have a Ruach too, so let's just treat them fair too.
Yeah, it's true. That's enlightening for me, because the terms, the Ruach in particular, I've encountered before.
Yeah, wind, breath, spirit.
Right, it's more generally the wind, breath, and spirit as having been breathed into mankind uniquely, humankind. And I totally agree with that. I mean, and I especially respect it as the Jewish conception of it.
So I just wanted to clarify that. But it sounds like in our conversations regarding shooter versus terrorist, what it really comes down to is we need to restore the humanity within humans somehow.
Precisely.
And that's why we have this narrative. But everybody needs to have their narrative with their neighbors, their colleagues, with your voicemail if you have to, somehow. Get out the words. Right. Talk about it.
And when you start thinking in terms of mutation, no two individual humans are identical.
It's true.
Relative to you, I'm a mutant. Relative to me, you're a mutant.
Thanks.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, we are not identical.
Despite me getting laser eye surgery, I don't have laser eyes. I want to clarify.
Yeah, you're seeing into me in ways that you're not supposed to. Now, all I'm really saying there is, one of the tough things to come to grips with, of the many to come to grips with, is there's always, just like there's this tendency to think that science and theology, reason and faith are at odds, they really aren't. They're just differences that need to be harmonized resonantly. By the same token, the individual and the society, the individual and the community, the individual and the collective, the one and the many, everybody thinks there's a conflict and a tension there. No, there are differences, but the objective, the goal, the noble, the right, the just, the true thing to do is to harmonize those differences. And we are going to keep coming back to that. I mean, to me, that's lesson number one that came out of the cohort, was mandorla resonant harmonies. And, of course, I extended that to the triquetra.
We need to connect our commonality, and we need to embrace that. And
while respecting our individuality.
Yes. And if we manage to pull it off right, I say manage, I mean, I'm not getting into the religious perspective here, but if we manage to pull it off, maybe we can stop even having to talk about shooter versus terrorist.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah. What a wonderful world. Sorry, I live too close to Disney World.
All right, well, listeners, be sure to tune in for our future episodes. We have an amazing season planned for you, and we hit our time limit here. I mean, we could talk for hours on this.
We will be talking for more hours.
I think that this gives enough to further your dialogue where you have it, because there's no point listening to this podcast if it's not causing you to think and expand on your own thought processes and your own worldview.
And interact with others about it.
Yes.
Including us.
Yes, we love to hear from you. Social media, websites, email. You can even use the Anchor FM app to leave us voice messages.
Yeah.
We want to hear from you.
And if we were doing a video, you'd see that I'm wearing the Simiobites Bite Me t-shirt.
That is true, yes, yes. Yeah, the Bite
Me
shirt.
I think it's the one that has been sold, right?
At the moment, yes. We do have the website, simiobites.com. If you head there, you can find the links to Terry's personal blog post that follow up with this conversation. Mine, you can find the links to listening to this podcast on any platform that exists so far.
Yeah.
And you can also find the links to our cool swag that helps defray the costs of maintaining the hosting fees, domain, blah, blah, blah.
My closing comment would be, we're here for you, so be here with us.
Definitely. All right. Signing off. Talk to you next time.
That's a good one.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semiobites is a podcast co-hosted by Yedbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiach analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semiobites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.